session number 9437, reel 6.
Elizabeth Hughes, tape 6. Did you see any evidence of communication, you know, roads, railways, from the air?
No railways, certainly. And I suppose that we may have seen some roads to begin with, but as we got near Yan'an, there are no roads at all. And I suppose we may have seen the footpaths, because they're so well used, they would show up from the air with the sparse vegetation. But no roads at all.
You mentioned the little cave dwellings, which you could see signs of from the air.
Yes.
Would there have been many villages sort of scattered about?
Well, I can't quite remember how I saw them from the air, but certainly when later, the villages are very frequent. Every 3 to 5 miles, there seems to be a village. Very small, and no communication but footpaths between them. There are a few bigger towns, and I suppose we may have flown over some, because a lot of them are walled towns. But it was a great thrill when we actually got to Yan'an, because we'd heard that it had been bombed by the Japanese, and it was the first time I'd seen aerial photos in the newspapers, of course. But it was interesting to see a town that had been flattened by bombing. You could see the floor pans of the houses in the main part of the town, and you could see where the town had been rebuilt, where people were living. But, of course, in Yan'an, because of the bombing, people had moved a mile or so away to the various valleys in Yan'an to get away from the bombing. There was a white pagoda in Yan'an, which is a great landmark. And although the Japanese used to use that as a marker when they were bombing, The locals didn't want it removed, and consequently it was left standing there in spite of the fact that it did guide the Japanese in. Yan'an also is at the meeting of two rivers, so it's and there's quite a bit of open plain there, which makes it rather spectacular from the air.
How big is it, Yan'an? You know, what size?
Oh, it's a very small town by anything we have in England. I suppose a mile and a half either way around this river would be the absolute maximum that it was then, if that. And in the middle, I seem to remember, there was this, you could see where the Japanese had bombed what was the original old town flat. There, of course, those were houses built up in the ordinary way, freestanding. But they must have had wooden roofs, perhaps, or something oh dear, it's difficult to remember now.
Did you get a feeling of isolation, that it was isolated from the world?
Yes. I mean, everything was friendly there, but there was no way except flying that you could get anywhere in a hurry. Then it was it was right in the middle of hundreds of miles of this lowest country.
Did it make you appreciate why the communists had chosen that spot?
Yes. Also, of course, it was land that nobody else wanted, because it wasn't fertile. They chose well in that they were left in peace, because nobody wanted the land. And, of course, it was inaccessible. The planes came down, and we were met immediately by many friendly people, and including the only 5 members of the American observation team. They can't all have been there, because they always left somebody back at headquarters with the radio. But we also met a lot of other important people. There were also journalists there. There were, at that time, right the way through the few months we were in Yan'an, there were always journalists coming and going, and they were very pleased to welcome them and answer any questions they wanted to know. Dr. Ma was there. Now, he's a very interesting person. George Harton is his European name. He's an American citizen and still holds an American passport. He is Armenian extraction, I think, and I think he got his medical degree in Switzerland, so before he came to China he was pretty cosmopolitan. He came in 1933, and somehow stayed on and on and on, and although he retained his American citizenship. And he had done a great deal of excellent work. He's said to have eliminated venereal disease in Shanghai, and before he went on, I presume, on the Long March anyway, he'd been in Yan'an for some time. Possibly he wasn't on the Long March, but he certainly had been in Yan'an a long time.
Were any of the Communist Party people there to welcome
you? Yes, yes, there was General Zhu De, and...
Could you tell me about him? Because he's still alive, I think, isn't he?
He must be a very, very old man, because he was old then. At least he seemed old. It's difficult sometimes to judge the age of Chinese. Yes, he was at the airport, and I don't remember. Later on, we met Zhou Enlai and Mao Zedong, but there were obviously people who were party members, but who mainly to escort the journalists.
You've mentioned this United States observation team.
Yes.
What were they there for?
There were peace teams meant to be liaising between the communists and the nationalists, and they were the representatives of these peace talks, which broke down soon, really about Christmas time, I think, and the Americans withdrew in March. We were taken. Somehow we went by jeep to the guest house more or less in the centre of Yan'an, where they had where the Americans were living there. There was quite a large area, I think, with rooms to put up all these journalists that kept coming and going, and other foreigners. Somewhere at that time there was Anna Louise Strong, the American author and writer, who I presume I met. There was also a Czech dentist who'd been there. I can't remember whether she arrived before we did or later, but she did some splendid work without any electricity. She had a hand drill and so on. She wasn't actually in Yan'an. She was somewhere outside, because I know I had... she filled a tooth for me. And another one she did for Dr. Peter Early, who he said it was a splendid job. And she came to the hospital at some time because she had a little brown mole on her hand and she wanted to have it removed... because she thought it was the sort of thing that might go malignant. She was a splendid person. She wouldn't ride a horse, and apparently she said she was carried in a litter when they took her anywhere, and she said even that wasn't terribly comfortable. But she was, she really put her work tremendously hard and was a very splendid personality. There was a journalist called Jack Chen, who I remember, because he did a drawing. He was also an artist. He did a drawing for me of a little Chinese boy. His mother was Chinese and his father... No, perhaps his father was Chinese and his mother was a Negro, and I think he came from Jamaica. I remember a Swiss journalist, Mr. Bosshart, who we also met later in Peking, and there was an American agriculturalist, Ernest Enks. He wasn't a reporter. He was living there, and there was an experimental farm that he was in charge of at Yan'an, because this was where all the... work that was hoped to be permanent was being carried on, and he was trying to breed the most suitable type of grain, because the birds used to take the millet so badly. They were trying to get breed a nice hairy one that the birds couldn't get to the seed and so on. And then he'd brought in some sperm, and they were trying to breed milk cows. The Chinese don't like milk, but anyway, it is something that could be very useful. It was a great shame because later the experimental farm was completely destroyed, and all the years and years of work of this breeding was destroyed. But Enks was still in China when we left. We met him again several times.
Who was it destroyed by? Would it have been...
Oh, by the Nationalists. That happened after we left Yan'an, which I'll explain in a minute. There were also... there were two Russian doctors in Yan'an that were there to look after Mao Zedong. And when they left, I'm not quite sure. I imagine when they went travelled with Mao when he finally left.
Were they the only Russians?
They were the only Russians we saw, yes. I think there had been Russians earlier, but they'd all been withdrawn except these doctors. There must have been other journalists there, because from my husband's diary, I find the names of Father Patrick O'Connor of the Catholic Press, who is now a US citizen, but he'd come from Ireland. There was a Mark Gain, who had a movie camera. There was John Roderick of the Association of Press. There was a reporter, an English reporter, from the Kemsley News and from Reynolds News. And there was also somebody called Sid Rittenberg, who other members of the team have noted in their diary was a very lively person, but I'm afraid I don't recall him. The medical people that also, I don't really remember, Dr. Jensen of UNRWA, the medical supplies officer. He had studied in Vienna and had been in Spain in the Civil War and had come to China in 1939 and had been there working for the Red Cross almost on and off ever since. And there was a Dr. Orloff that Dr. Peter Early met in San Chao in September 1947. And Margaret Stanley mentions a journalist that had been in Yunnan, Tilman Durden, Jack Chen, who I do remember, John Roderick, Mark Gain, who my husband mentions, and Hammond Kensley.
Where all the foreigners? Were you kept together?
Yes, we were at that time, because there was this so-called guest house. There was a splendid Christmas party given at the guest house. I think it was hosted by the American Army Group. Many of the people I've mentioned were there, including Chang Ching, later the leader of the Gang of Four, who was Mao's wife. She was then very young and beautiful. She was a film star, of course.
Did you see her yourself?
Oh, yes, yes. We were all... there weren't so very many people there, about 20 or 30, perhaps. Yeah. So it was quite a... that was Christmas time.
Yes, what sort of lady was she? Could you tell us more about her? Because we get these sort of impressions that she's quite a virago now.
Yes, well, of course, she was quite young then. And I didn't really come to speak with her, but she obviously played her part as host of foreigners very well. And at New Year, we went to another party where there were a similar group of people, including Mao himself. And, in fact, Jack Dodds danced with Chang Ching, I think, which was...
What would she have worn? What sort of clothing?
Oh, yes. Now, I haven't said this. When we got to Yunnan, you didn't see any foreign clothes except some of the journalists. And everyone wore blue padded coats and blue padded trousers and caps with hats with ear flaps. It must have been extremely cold because the rivers were frozen, even though in December. In fact, they were frozen so solid that you could drive a jeep over them. At least there were places you could drive a jeep over them or take a cart over, which was a good thing because there were no stone bridges. There were wooden bridges that they used in the summertime, but the floods and the melting snows always broke them down again, and they always had to rebuild them the next year. Mostly, vehicles would use Fords when there wasn't ice, and then as the ice froze, they would test it and actually take the vehicles over the ice. But some people had sheepskin garments. The camel drivers and the muleteers who went over long distances would often have sheepskin coats and waistcoats and hats too. And they'd often wear heavy pebble glasses, mainly to keep the sand out of their eyes, because when it's windy, the lowest country lifts and you get terrible sandstorms in the dry season.
What do you mean by heavy pebble glasses?
Well, they would be glasses which really wouldn't help their sight at all, but acted to protect their eyes. Oh, yes, and a lot of people wore surgical white masks, you know, like you wear in the operating theatre.
But these glasses, were they made of pebble?
No, they're thick glass. Mm. Thick glass lenses. But a lot of people wore masks. Even when we had dances, you'd find them wearing these masks, partly because they were absolutely infectious. You know, they wanted to prevent any kind of infection. There was a lot of TB about it. And partly because of the dust, but the dust could hardly have applied when you were having a party inside.
As you were saying about this party, and I was asking what the communist ladies would have worn.
Oh, yes, so Madame Mao was wearing a suit of blue trousers and a blue jacket, but it was better cut. It was rather interesting. One of our interpreters had been a quartermaster, and we quite soon were given these padded clothes, which were kept the cold out much better and were much more suitable to wear than our heavy army greatcoats and ordinary woolen trousers. The padded clothes were splendid. Also, it was like taking your own armchair around with you, because we didn't have any soft furniture at all. And but there were various grades, you see. And this interpreter said to us, "Oh yes, you've got major's grade uniforms, you see." And that the trousers actually had fly buttons. Some of the lower grade ones, the trousers were just made very large, and you'd sort of wrap them over and put a waistband round to hold them up. And there were various other refinements with pockets and things. So the really top grades, Joe and I, for instance, always looked extremely dapper. Their clothes would be similar, but they would be properly tailored and much better finished than some other people. So they didn't look quite like sort of snowballs.
Did you meet Zhou Enlai yourself?
Yes, I did. Yes, he spoke voluble English, but it was rather difficult to understand, I found. He was very, very charming, but I did have difficulty in following his English.
When would you have met him then? What sort of occasion?
Like the New Year party. He was there, I'm sure, and there were other receptions that we went to, where there was usually a feast, and we'd talk beforehand, and with journalists, I suppose, as well, and it was very fascinating. I felt I didn't know enough about the political situation and so on to talk properly, I'm afraid, to make the best of such a wonderful opportunity. But his personality was very noticeable. He had great charm and also ability to talk to anyone and mix freely with everyone.
He looks very handsome from his
photograph. Yes, he was. He was a very good-looking man, yes. Mao was rather taller than the average Chinese, I felt, and he wore a great cloak. It was rather an impressive figure.
And did you speak to Mao at all?
Well, I shook hands with him, but we didn't talk to him. No, he sort of went along the line and shook hands with everyone there.
Was he obviously the leader at that time, do you think?
Yes. Yeah, oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yes.
Where would they have been staying, Zhou Enlai and Mao Zedong?
Well, I imagine in one of the side valleys, because when we went back to Yan'an later, one of the things that all the visitors had to do, well, were expected to do, was to visit the various places that Mao had stayed. There were roads connecting these valleys within the bigger valley of Yan'an, and they would be 10 or 12 miles apart, and I expect they'd be would have been staying in one of these compounds, not right in the centre of Yan'an. Of course, you see, these caves in Yan'an, they're dug out of the cliff like a section of underground tunnel. Consequently, they're like air raid shelters in their very being. The sandstone is very soft, and of course, if you hit the mouth of the cave, or directly outside the front of the cave, you would do a certain amount of damage. But nevertheless, they were probably quite as safe as most of the air raid shelters in England. And so it was just a question of staying away from the actual centre of the Yan'an town in these small collection of caves some miles in a side valley. The valleys were pretty narrow, and it was pretty difficult to bomb in the side valleys.
When you met Mao, did he speak English?
No. I don't think he made any attempt to speak any English at all.
Was he as gregarious as Zhou Enlai?
I don't think so, no. I think he had rather an aura of importance around himself and kept himself certainly at that party. My memory is that he was rather aloof.
How about Zhu Dei? Did you see any more of him?
Yes, we met him on a number of occasions. He, I think, was fairly gregarious.
What was his role? Did you have any idea what these people were doing?
Well, we knew he was head of the army, and we imagined that now the war was more or less over, he was having a rest period in Yan'an, and they were looking to the future to decide how their activities should continue in the peace. Of course, it didn't work out like that. There had been skirmishes in Yunnan, and the hospital where we were meant to have been worked had been mainly evacuated. But at the time we went in at the beginning of December, the plan was to bring all the equipment and personnel and patients back to the hospital where we were intending to work and teach. And of course, things didn't work out like that at all.
You mentioned earlier, Elizabeth, how the Yunnan was populated by people going up supporting the communists, you know, educated people. Were they interacting in the town with the local population as well?
Yes, I think so. The local people were mostly very simple people. And certainly once we left Yunnan itself, the local people wouldn't come to foreign doctors, and they didn't like to go to Chinese foreign-trained doctors. And they kept themselves very much... they were really the two groups, although there was no animosity between them. In Yunnan, there was an enormous proportion of people who'd come from... because they were communists, not because they lived there. And they'd come from all parts of China. And not only the well-educated, our little Xiaogueis, who were allocated to look after us... they both came from other parts of China, and one of them could read, the other one couldn't read. And the cook we had, he couldn't read, but he was not a local man. A lot of people had come more because they were communists and lived in Yunnan. And as I say, they got on well with the local people. And we didn't hear so much in Yunnan, but later we heard always that the communists were so fair and didn't tax them in advance. And if they gave any services to the party, they were always rewarded either by remission of taxes or allocation of land or so on. The little Xiaogueis who looked after us had certificates saying that their parents in quite different parts of China had been given special concessions of land and so on, which was... certainly there was a feeling that you would be fairly treated by the communist authorities, which was quite different from... Chiang Kai-shek.
And did all these different people, did they really work together on a basis of equality, would you think?
Yes, I think so. Oh, yes. 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 When I remember being told that some of the more educated people hated having to spin cotton and so on, which they were expected to do, but Mao Zedong insisted that everyone must do manual work, as well as anything for which they had further training. And some of them didn't like it at all, but they felt they had to do as Mao wanted.
Could I ask you now about the International Peace Hospital? You know, could you first of all describe the structure of it? I know there were some buildings, were there not?
Yes, the only buildings was a stone operating theatre, which had an excellent system of heating under the floor. But this was very expensive to do, so they couldn't operate very often because of the difficulty of getting fuel to get the theatre up to a suitable temperature for operating. There was a large theatre and a small theatre and several ancillary rooms in this block. And it was brick-built and it had glass windows, which was quite something. There was another cave, a pretty large cave, that had a lot of glass in the front, which had previously been used as a theatre. But it was used as for changing dressings and that sort of thing at this point. The hospital was quite unlike anything you would possibly imagine in England. It was rows and rows of caves in terraces above each other, up a great bank in a small side valley. And there were some freestanding buildings at the bottom. But in this part of the country, they often built buildings with stone and mud bricks. But they made them like the section of tunnel, like the same shape as the caves would have been. The caves were used as wards, and they had fixed wooden beds in them. Not all the peasants' caves and the caves we lived in had... No, they didn't. No. The caves the peasants live in have kongs, which are mud platforms, with the cooking stove by the side of it. and the flues from the cooking stove go underneath the kong and up to a chimney, so that the kong was warmed by the flue from the cooking stove. The Chinese sleep in pugais, which are like very large, thin, cotton-filled quilts, and they fold them over and lie on them and then wrap them over the top of them, and they probably use their clothes and shoes as a pillow. So the family would sleep on this kong, which would be big enough to accommodate a number of people. But in the wards, they didn't have beds like that. They had wooden beds, three or four wooden beds in each of the caves. When the hospital was running properly, the patients used to bring their own bedding with them, and there was a room where they used to fumigate the bedding they brought in, because everyone has lice there. Before they took it into the wards, that was the best they could do. And then there were some white quilts with the Red Cross on them that they used to put over their own bedding when they brought in. Patients came in. But when we first went up there, there were very few staff and very few patients. They kept saying that, you know, the patients and the staff would be brought back. Joanne and I started language classes, and various other activities went on. Doug was able to get a few things going in the lab. It was largely a problem of materials, too. Some operations were done in the operating theatre, and there was a good, keen operating staff. I've always found Chinese absolutely excellent at operating room work. I think they had boiling water sterilizers for instruments and pressure. That's right, they had a big high pressure steam autoclave type thing for sterilizing dressings. And the doctors eventually started outpatients. Then we collected one extremely interesting patient. He was an army officer who'd been on the Long March, and at some point he'd been injured very badly in the mouth and lower jaw. All the injuries had healed up, but the scarring was very bad, and he couldn't close his mouth, which of course made swallowing very, very difficult. And he had to tube feed himself. He had a funnel and tube which he used to pass and only eat liquids.